I am Chris Domig, and this is the Viktor Frankl Project. Thanks so much for joining us. For over a decade, I have been intrigued by the life and work of Viktor Frankl, author of Man's Search for Meaning and founder of Logotherapy. Frankl's work has had a profound impact on my own life and for many around the world. I am on a quest to understand why Frankl's life continues to resonate with people, especially during times of adversity and suffering, and how we might all benefit from understanding the principles of Logotherapy, his meaning-centered approach. Whether you've never heard of Viktor Frankl or love his work, whether you've stumbled upon this conversation or sought us out, I want to welcome you. I'm so glad you are here, and I hope these conversations are encouraging to you.
And Man's Search for Meaning, you can read it if you're an academic, or you can read it if you're not. You can read it if you're a teenager. You get it. Something that is very, very universal, which is, what is life about? What is this yearning for meaning that we have? Is that a good thing or bad thing? Is it a normal thing? And does life have a meaning, even though it inevitably is connected with a certain amount of suffering that we'll have to endure?
Today, I am speaking with Alexander Vesely, director, filmmaker, and licensed psychotherapist. Alexander is also Viktor Frankl's grandson. I've had the great honor of getting to know Alex and his family over the last few years when I have visited Vienna. Alex, it's so great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you.
Today we want to talk about the book Man's Search for Meaning. I guess I want to start with a more personal question. Do you remember the first time you read the book?
Yes, I do. It was relatively late in my life. I was 19 years old, and I remember it because I read it on a plane going to Toronto, Canada, to a logotherapy conference, a big logotherapy conference that takes place every 2 years. And it was in the year 1993, and my grandfather, that was the year my grandfather made his last trip to the U.S., right before that. And after that, his doctors told him to better not be flying long distance anymore. And so for this conference, he was invited, but he couldn't go. So he sent my sister and me to kind of go in his place and read a letter and talk with the people there. And so that's what we did. And I remember, well, it's about time that I know a little more about what Grandpa is doing whenever he's traveling around the world. And so I read Man's Search for Meaning on the plane. And by the time I arrived in Toronto, I was up to speed.
I love that story. It's also so interesting to me because the first time I read Man's Search for Meaning, I was on a plane from New York to Texas.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I still remember the passage that first stood out to me. But the fact that we were both on a plane when we were reading this is really interesting. So you were reading this book in preparation to participate in a conference that your grandfather could not attend, and you and your sister were going in his stead. Is that correct?
Yes. You said it much shorter. that was the reason. I mean, I had planned to read it at some point, but, you know, it kind of shows you when people ask me, what's it like to be, you know, Viktor Frankl's grandson? I say, you know, for me, it wasn't the Viktor Frankl. He was Grandpa. And first and foremost, and I think because he had such a big personality, the fact that he was known and that he helped people even through just his writings and not even being present, so to speak. That was just one aspect that, and not a very important one when you're a kid.
So in the same vein, I would assume, as he was your grandfather, not this famous author and founder of Logotherapy, I would assume that in reading his book, you were approaching it as, well, this is a story that my grandfather wrote down, rather than here's an international bestseller that has changed many people's lives. Do you remember any particular reactions you had when you first encountered the book?
Yeah, it's funny that you say it that way, because that's exactly what didn't happen. When I read it, it didn't feel like, okay, this is my grandfather speaking at first, because I couldn't believe that this was the same person who had, you know, undergone such tragedy, and that would be my grandfather, who was, you know, such a healthy, happy, funny guy. So it kind of gave me a new, it made me see a different side of my grandfather.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that because what he's describing in the book felt so alien to what you knew about your grandfather, it was almost hard to reconcile how both could be part of the same person?
At first. And then I realized that probably one of the reasons this book is such a powerful book and continues to be a book that has and still does help many people is that this is a book that shows how you can come back and how you can survive tragedy and not only break, but become an even better version of yourself, if you like, or the best version of yourself. I understood when I was finished that, for example, take humor. When he was such a humorous, such a funny guy, and it would be the assumption that somebody who has lived through this wouldn't be able to be a funny guy anymore. And it showed me another side and a more complete impression of who this man was, to have overcome and to have gone through this suffering and to not only retain but utilize humor. And he would say that you know, humor was a survival strategy. It was one way to cope with the absurdity of the suffering that was going on around him.
Did you read it in German or in English?
I read it in English.
And did you later read it in German as well?
No, I don't think I read it in German. No.
That's interesting. I'm curious to know, since we're both bilingual, if there's something within language that, this is just an open question, whether there's books or passages that are better understood in the original language, even though I've found that all the English translations are quite excellent.
I think, you know, the fact that he was very meticulous when it came to translations. You know, he even, you know, one day he had the flu, and he wasn't somebody who could sit around and do nothing. So he decided to learn Spanish. He had a little book. It's still in his library, actually. It's called 1,000 Words in Spanish, and it's a little Spanish course. And so he went through that. He was an avid reader, and he learned very quickly. So by the time he felt better, he had also learned Spanish. And so, his Spanish wasn't perfect, and he had a thick accent, but it was good enough so that when he went to lecture in, you know, Spanish speaking countries, and they put a translator at his side, he would be able to correct the translators if he heard, you know, if he thought the translation wasn't to the point. So he went over the translated versions of his books, and he made sure that they're translated well, and I think they are. But of course, there are always nuances that are hard to translate, also because they have a different cultural background and self-understanding, and I don't see that problem that much, though, because the things he talks about are so universal. But there is, of course, has always been a problem with one particular expression, and that's the word spiritual in English, which, you know, means, has a religious connotation. Now, in German, you have two words for spiritual, which are geistig and geistlich, and they mean slightly different things, in that one is kind of the spirit, and spiritual as the English spirit, so that's a religious context, and the other is geistig, which has no religious context. It's more of a, you know, the cognitive ability capacity to think and to think freely and to have, you know, authority over one's own thoughts. And so this is actually one of the reasons that contributed to a lot of his work being rejected or misunderstood as religious, because when he talked about the geistig spiritual dimension that we all, you know, are the agents of our own decisions, that would get a religious ring to it in English, because there's only the word spiritual. So of course he always tried to explain that, and he later changed that to, you know, speaking of the noetic dimension. But it's that again doesn't quite, it never quite found the perfect word for it that would be easy to understand and clear. And that's only possible in German. And I think it's, there's a reason why German is referred to as the language of the philosophers.
Yeah, that's, I want to talk more about how these words have different connotations in English than they do in German. I think it's a great way to transition to how Man's Search for Meaning came to be. If people have or know of Viktor Frankl, most people know him because of the book Man's Search for Meaning, or Trotzdem Jahr zum Leben sagen in German. And because of that, they encounter his views on logotherapy through that book, and therefore often believe that your grandfather survived the concentration camps and came out and then developed logotherapy. Why is it that there continues to be this misunderstanding of the timeline of when logotherapy was developed versus when Man's Search for Meaning was written?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because whenever this misunderstanding is presented, I think people usually don't know the literature, because otherwise they would see how this does not make any sense at all. Because in the book Man's Search for Meaning, my grandfather explains how he had to throw away his book manuscript in which he had put down the foundations for logotherapy, his approach, how he had to throw this manuscript into the trash upon entering Auschwitz, which was a huge disappointment for him, that you know, because to the last moment, that was the one thing he took with him, was that manuscript. And he had hoped to bring the book out, but there was no time anymore to do that. And so he writes in Man's Search for Meaning how he had to throw away his life's work, basically, at the entrance of Auschwitz and leave it behind, not knowing if he would ever survive to do anything about it, or if anybody would ever, I mean, he knew basically he was pretty certain that this would be the end of Viktor Frankl and thereby the end of logotherapy. So how can anybody believe that he invented logotherapy in the camp? It doesn't make any sense. He writes it in Man's Search for Meaning that logotherapy had been developed in the years before that. There were some publishers who kind of, I think, to market Man's Search for Meaning, did that under the tagline, "From the concentration camps comes a new approach to psychotherapy." He always rejected that. He always set that straight whenever he was asked. And he actually wrote several letters to his publisher to stop spreading this misinformation.
Well, and on a certain level, I think even if it wasn't for early publishers trying to get the book that way, there is so much overlap between logotherapy and his personal reflections in Man's Search for Meaning that if you weren't paying attention to that part that you just mentioned, you could still come away from it constructing your own timeline that would make sense of that, right?
I think that's how most people see it and do it. And I've heard, you know, I've met a lot of people who kind of refer to only the book, right? To Man's Search for Meaning as their source of logotherapy. And of course, in the English book, there is a little chapter on logotherapy. It's called Logotherapy in a Nutshell in the back of the book, which gives you a little bit of an overview and also tells you something about the story, because that chapter does not exist in the German book. He never thought his scientific literature mixed with his personal book. The book he always referred to as the most important book was The Doctor and the Soul, which was Ärztliche Seelsorge in German, which was the book that he wrote before the war, and he had to throw away in the camps. He reconstructed it in the camps. And then when he got to Vienna, everything he had in his possession was the attempt of that reconstruction on little snippets of paper. Luckily, he had given a copy to a friend before he was deported, and he actually looked for that friend when he came back to Vienna, and his friend was still there, and his friend also had managed to save that copy that he had given him before the war. And then he started to reconstruct The Doctor and the Soul, which was the only book he ever wanted to write or anticipated that he would write. And this is an interesting time because he also kind of used that. He was so at such a low point in his personal life, I mean, coming back from the concentration camps, still hoping that he would find some of his family alive, and it turned out nobody had survived. And so it was also a help for him to kind of stay alive and to keep himself alive and keep himself at least busy, to not completely fall into the void, or as he would call it, as it's called in logotherapy, the existential vacuum, that awareness that there is no one that's been waiting for me. So are there any tasks for me left to do? It was a very sad time. And so he started immediately to, I mean, knowing that and knowing how dangerous it is to then do nothing and you know, basically give up. I think he became very active in reconstructing this manuscript and from the previous version and augmenting it. And part of this augment was a chapter in the back that he added, which was about the concentration camp experience. And he actually wrote a letter to another friend of his, and that letter still exists from the time, in which he says, you know, I cannot feel any joy. Everything's, has lost any emotion. So, you know, he was a traumatized man. But he said, I'm reconstructing that book and I've just finished it. I don't think it's as good as it was before the war. He actually said, I think it's lost the spring. It's not as good. But the publisher thought differently and published it and said, returned to him by asking him, would you consider writing a book on that last chapter you put in there? Because he thought that this was an interesting approach to kind of explain the concentration camp experience from the perspective of a psychiatrist, of a psychologist. And so my grandfather said, sure. And so he wrote Man's Search for Meaning in 9 consecutive days. And it was for him an important experience too. He referred to it as a cathartic experience. So he got all this unspeakable experiences and suffering and tragedies onto paper. And that became Man's Search for Meaning. And the original title actually is more fitting in a way to what this book is. It's called Ein Psycholog erlebt das Konzentrationslager, erlebt das KZ, which means a psychologist. The literal translation is a psychologist experiences the concentration camp.
Man's Search for Meaning has sold over 16 million copies since its publication in 1946 and has been translated into over 54 languages. It is consistently listed as one of the 100 most influential books on bestseller lists. And yet Viktor Frankl had initially considered publishing the book anonymously in an effort to draw attention not to himself, but to the universal experience of trying to find meaning amidst suffering. That's fascinating. So, just to summarize, to clarify the misunderstanding, Viktor Frankl was working on what he considered to be his thesis book about logotherapy prior to the war, titled Ärztliche Seelsorge. The title in English is The Doctor and the Soul. He's deported. He leaves one copy behind with a friend. And one copy, if I'm correct, his first wife helped sew into his coat, right?
Yes.
And one of the first risks he takes in the concentration camps is not to at first give that up, even though the guards demanded that they hand over anything that was of personal value. And then at maybe the second or third checkpoint, after one of the inmates who had been there longer basically tells him, you're going to lose everything, including this manuscript.
Yeah, he describes it in the book.
Right. So then he loses the manuscript. He's able to make some notes, which is also beautifully and hauntingly described in the book Man's Search for Meaning, of when he's sick with typhus. And he's trying to keep himself awake. He tries to reconstruct the book on bits of piece of paper, survives the camps, comes home, manages to track down the friend who still happens to have a copy. Then he reconstructs the original manuscript, but adds one chapter about his experiences in the camps. Sends it to the editor. The editor says, great, I would actually like to know more about your experiences there. Could you imagine writing a full book? And then he writes Man's Search for Meaning in 9 days.
Yes.
That's fascinating. And he felt strongly that this book should be published anonymously. And in the end, though, he did put his name to that. Can you tell us that story?
I'm not sure if he felt strongly about publishing it anonymously. He did feel that he could express himself more freely, knowing that it's anonymous. Yeah, he felt free, and he saw himself. He was always a doctor. He was always a scientist. He saw himself as that, and so to write a book that was more personal in nature to him, that he really did that. Upon the invitation of the publisher, and thinking that, you know, perhaps if this ends up on somebody's hands who has had a similar experience as I have, and a lot of people had. I mean, it was post-war Vienna. A lot of people had survived and were suffering, like him. And if it can help a couple of people, then good. Then it was worth it. But it's not part of the scientific body of my work. Has nothing. There's no direct connection with the book that I had conceived and the theories and the discoveries that I had made. The discovery of meaning and its significance in the field of psychotherapy, that had nothing to do with Auschwitz. So I think he just saw that as a little side project, and so the first edition came out without the name. There's still, you can still find copies on eBay.
I was actually looking at the early copies of this book, and I was curious about the cover image, because the first book has some barbed wire in the background, and then it looks like a small puddle of water and broken glasses, which I assume are his.
Yes, and they actually look like his. Amazing. I don't know if the cover artist knew that. I think he liked that. I'm not sure if he suggested this image or if it was one of the images that were suggested to him. I'm sure that's information that can be unearthed. But he liked it because he thought that the broken glasses were kind of symbolic for that situation of here's a person who's like deeply intellectual, and this is how much, you know, this is worth in a surrounding like a concentration camp. It's stepped on, it's broken, it's worthless. And there was also a situation in which he was severely maltreated by one of the SS officers, and he hit him, and he hit him so hard in the face that his glasses flew off. And he remembered that. I think it's one of the moments that were very part of his personal experiences in the camps.
In more recent publications of the book, the image that is most common is a bird sitting on some barbed wire. Do you know how that image became so well liked amongst publishers?
I don't know. That was that's a new design that came after his death. So your guesses are as good as mine. What do you think?
Well, there's a passage in the book when a number of things come together. I think it's one of the more beautiful passages. And he remembers his wife, who was dead at the time, but he didn't know. And he thinks about how love is such a strong force that can connect us as people. And then he sees a light go on in a farmhouse on the hills. And he has a sense that there is meaning in life. And then a bird flew down and perched and looked at him. I don't think it perched. He doesn't describe the bird having perched on some fence, but that image of a bird making contact with him, or his perception of that, I think, fused with that whole passage, is one that I believe stands out to many people, or at least it stands out to me. I wonder if it stood out to whoever had the idea of fusing, of bringing together barbed wire and a bird. That's my guess.
I think that's a good guess. I would also think that bird is kind of associated with the freedom, and to contrast that with barbed wire, which is kind of the symbol for the opposite of freedom, and how you could manage to be free internally, even though you were not free externally. It reminds me of one of the beautiful letters that he kept, a letter from a young man from Texas who had a diving accident and found himself in the situation to be a quadriplegic the rest of his life, young man, 19 years old. And he read Man's Search for Meaning and wrote a letter to my grandfather, this kid from Texas. This is the 1980s we're talking about, or 1970s. I think it was 1980. And wrote this letter, and he said, "You have shown me," I'm that might not be the exact quote, but he said, you have shown me that I am free. You were in prison. I am in prison because of his body and his inability to move. Yet you have shown me that I am free. So the freedom of the mind and of the spirit, and that you're always free to find the way, your personal way of dealing with life and those things you can change and how to accept the things that you can't change. And that doesn't go away. It just changes. And so this was one of the things that my grandfather cherished, this letter and quoted this young man, Jerry Long was his name, who had such a deep insight, because here he was, a baseball playing kid who had planned to become a professional baseball player, and he actually had a good chance. That accident happened when he was on a, what are they called, tryouts for the Houston Astros. So they were in a baseball camp when he had this diving accident. And so he finished that letter by saying, "I broke my neck, but it didn't break me," which is so to the point of kind of that, that's kind of in essence what my grandfather tried to say with his own work.
It reminds me of, in the afterword of the edition of Man's Search for Meaning that I have, there is a story about an Israeli soldier who lost legs in the Yom Kippur War, who wrote your grandfather about a similar transformative experience after having read the book. And your grandfather wonders whether there's such a thing as audio bibliotherapy, which is the healing through reading, which I have to tell you a personal story that in working on this theater production of Viktor Frankl's legacy and how one can use these questions of meaning in our own life. You know, we had a performance last November. And then this man came up to me afterwards with a copy of Man's Search for Meaning. And he said to me, "My name is Charles, and I got out of jail 3 weeks ago. And while I was in jail, I read this book and it changed my life." And at first, I didn't hear him because there was a lot of noise around. And so he said all that. And I thought to myself, that's not possibly what he could have said. So I just asked him again. I said, "How did you come here?" And he said, "Well, I heard about this and this is my story." And as I was sort of standing there stunned, a middle-aged man came to me and he said, "My name is Mike. And I am the correction officer of Charles. And we came here together. And everything he just told you is true. I didn't give him the book. He found it when he was in jail. And I met him a few weeks ago. And he was a changed man in his attitude towards many things. And he said it was because of reading this book." So that's as close as I have come to actually hear one of these countless stories of people who have had a transformational experience. I think is not too grand a word to use after reading this particular book. Which begs the question, your grandfather really wanted to separate his scientific work from his personal reflections. He writes this book in 9 days, gets it off his chest in the hope that it will help anyone. And unbeknownst to him, though, what keeps happening is that people find their entryway to his work mostly through this particular book that he didn't think would, or he didn't know if it would be effective or not, but he certainly didn't think that people would engage with his work primarily through Man's Search for Meaning. How did he make sense of that during his lifetime, or how do you understand that very interesting conundrum?
I think he never really understood why that happened. And at first, the book did not sell well. It was not a good going book in German, and it was nothing that he didn't lament that. He didn't care. it was really something. I think he thought that about all his books. Whoever's going to find it and find it helpful or useful, then it was worth it. And if it's one person, then it was already worth doing it. So he wasn't, you know, checking or expecting the numbers. He was not out to make a big name of himself. He didn't need to do that. He was a doctor. He was the head of the neurologic polyclinic. He had a theory that he saw worked. He applied it. He helped people. He had private practice. So I think he was through and through a doctor and a teacher, and not somebody who was out to make himself known, make his name known as an and even less as an author. If anything, you want to be known for bringing meaning into the context of psychotherapy where it had been missing, and where it was missing and where it was hurting people, the fact that it was missing. And to bring it in there, and even if somebody else had done that, he would have been just as happy. For some reason, nobody thought of that, and he did, and he saw it worked. And so he also didn't spend much time even, you know, doing the statistical research to prove that his theories work, which I think is why it took so long. And you know, now you have positive psychology and all the other meaning-centered therapies popping up here around the world, because it's kind of clear now. Nobody questions that you know, the meaning and purpose play a significant role in the well-being. And when Man's Search for Meaning became this phenomenon, he was a little, I think he was taken aback a little. And that's why he put this little chapter on logotherapy into the back of the English edition, because it was kind of a piggyback. Because he thought, wait a minute, you know, it's great. You take something out of this story, but here's the theory. Here's what's important now, is to, help people and to use what I've proven before the war, and I could even apply it myself during the war, and saw that it had, you know, survival value when dealing with internal and external stresses, which he had found it before the war. I think he was more surprised that nobody listened before the war, and you know, suddenly people were listening because he had changed as a messenger. And it's not a academic work that needs a certain level of education and understanding of the topic before you can even enter it. And it's just as fascinating, but it's not everybody reads that. Not everybody can do something with it. And Man's Search for Meaning, you can read it if you're an academic, or you can read it if you're not. You can read it if you're a teenager. You get it, because it's talking about something that is very, very universal, which is, what is life about? What is this yearning for meaning that we have? Is that a good thing or bad thing? Is it a normal thing? And does life have a meaning, even though it inevitably is connected with a certain amount of suffering that we'll have to endure? And interesting story, when he first lectured in the U.S., he did so to a group of peers, psychiatrists. And after the presentation, the host asked my grandfather, "So what do you think? Did you notice that people were a little standoffish?" And he said, "Yes." And the hosts asked him again, "Well, do you know why? Did you wonder why?" And my grandfather said, "Well, I imagine they're all psychoanalysts, and they might not like everything I have to say, because I kind of, a lot of what I'm talking about is sort of counter psychoanalytic. It's a very different approach." And the host said, "No, that's not it." So he said, "What is it?" And he said, "These people know that you have suffered and you have overcome suffering, and they have not. It made them back off." And so from then on, he didn't get tired of saying, you know, do not compare suffering. Personal suffering is, by its very nature, something you can't compare, because it's personal. It's a personal experience. And he coined the phrase, "Everyone has their own Auschwitz."
There are obviously degrees of suffering, but by making this provocative statement, I think Frankl is encouraging us to reconsider what experiences are worthy of our attention. Many people minimize their own tragedies because they believe their suffering is trite compared to someone else's. However, I have never heard someone's honest life story and not been struck by both the brokenness and the beauty of it. It takes mentors to show us how to pay attention to the joys and tragedies of our own life. I have found Viktor Frankl to be such a mentor, as he shares with clarity and courage what he has experienced, and as a result allows us, his readers, to find the courage to view our lives in a new light. Wow. Yeah, I remember reading that as well, or maybe I saw it in your documentary. But I love that. I love that story. There's so many reasons why the book affects people. One of them is that within Western history, of course, all of history has had atrocities. And certainly within the Eastern Hemisphere, there are things that we in the Western world don't talk about as much that are equally atrocious. But within the Western world, the Holocaust still stands as the epitome of evil and suffering that people are sort of hold up, I think, in their own consciousness as something that is unsurmountable. And so that you, to have someone who survives it and is able to talk about the experiences in a hopeful way, are, I think, is daunting for people on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's the thing that is so attractive for people, because I think that people find their own stories implicated, their own Auschwitz, to use your grandfather's term, implicated in his experience. And so it's essentially saying, if someone else can survive that, then maybe there is a way through in my own suffering, right? And that there's a positive feedback loop. I don't even know if that's the right expression, but there's a positive cycle of encouragement that happens when you, not that your grandfather set out to be a mentor, but unbeknownst to him, he has become someone who people look up to, who has survived incredible hardship whilst continuing to believe in the meaning of life. It continues to be such a powerful story that people are attracted to. And I was thinking that it really has resonated cross-culturally, across languages, and class, right? This is not a piece of literature that only one particular person has been affected by. It's really a universal experience for those who have encountered it. Are there any other insights that you have had over the years, or stories that your grandfather told you, or even things that you witnessed in regards to this book that you could offer as to why it continues to resonate with people?
Well, I think what you just said is very interesting and beautiful and to the point. This is something I've heard, similar experiences from other people who kind of said, you know, if he could go through this, maybe I can go through what I'm dealing with right now. He was a truth seeker, and being a psychologist in dealing with human beings, I think the very interesting question that you know affects this story, or that's connected with this story, is that of how can you be a therapist, basically getting the strength and the best out of people, assuming that it's there in everybody, and how can you do that after having had the experience of, you know, the majority of a population in a country wanting to eradicate you and your family? I think to deal with that and to arrive at the insight that the most inhumane behavior is part of human nature, and it's within us as human beings. And that is why it's also not over. You know, if you look at any kind of time in the history of mankind, you will find atrocities and inhumanities. He said, you know, the Holocaust is something that, you know, nobody should look and say, okay, this, you know, this happened only in Germany at this time, and how proud can we be that it didn't happen in our country, right? We must be a better country. He criticized that. He said, you know, if something like the Holocaust happens, would be one hand saying, I'm just glad the other hand got a tumor and not me. That's ridiculous. It's always the whole organism. It's always the whole of humankind who is affected if something like this happens. And atrocities are happening, and they happened long before the Holocaust, and they are happening now. So to go in and look at humankind and to say, okay, we're capable of the worst, we're also capable of the best, it's in each of us, and it's a personal decision where to go, or which elements do I cultivate, and which ones do I want to, you know, not actualize. Those are the questions where I think he saw his work and the responsibility as somebody who's writing, as somebody who's doing therapy, and speaking to single individuals and to large crowds, and how to take a lesson from that universal suffering, and how can we deal with it, but also how can we prevent something like this happening in the future. These were kind of the big questions, and it's a warning too. What's going on? Are we vigilant enough to see what's going on in society as a whole, but also in our personal lives?
I'm fascinated by how he acknowledges that, you know, there are decent and indecent people, that goodness and evil exist, but that there is, as we talked about during our last conversation, that is something that exists in all of us, individually and collectively, so that we can't really escape the human condition.
One of the things that are unique to us human beings, this ability to tell between what's right and wrong and what's meaningful and what isn't, and to make a choice. And the phenomenon that he would say every human being has is his and her conscience, which kind of works as a little compass, as a meaning organ. This is a wordplay that works better in German, and you will understand it. He talked about the Sinnorgan versus the Sinnesorgan. So it's not a sensory capability, sense of smell and of, you know, sound and vision, but it is a sense organ, in a way, a meaning organ, in that our conscience is like a guide and usually points towards the direction of what's the meaningful choice in any given situation. It might not be the practical, it might not be the easy, it might not be the comfortable, and sometimes it means going against what the majority thinks to be right. But just because more people think it's right doesn't make it right. And so to listen to one's own conscience and to, you know, obey your own conscience, which again is a choice.
I actually think it's one thing that allows for so many people to have access to Victor's work. It's precisely because he's talking about it in ways that everyone has an idea of conscience, let's say, without having to ground yourself in a religious tradition. But you understand what is meant, at least when he's talking about it, and you are able to apply it to your own life. And that is something that continues to fascinate me, because I find there are so few places where people who take the questions of meaning seriously without wanting to immediately tie themselves to a particular worldview or religion, have to meet and talk about these things.
Absolutely. And I want to intersperse something, if I may. You say it doesn't require, the conscience doesn't require any religious background or personal belief in God, but it also doesn't exclude it. And that's kind of the beauty of it. My grandfather's work, logotherapy, is perhaps the first, evidently the first, but one of the few to this day psychological schools, schools of therapy that have no problem with widening that view if the patient brings that in. So if you believe your conscience is connected to God and it is something godly, then that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine too, because these are things that are out of the realm of a psychologist to decide. It would be unprofessional to make a value judgment on somebody else's religious beliefs. This is, in a way, this is none of the psychotherapist's business. A lot of other schools, they think differently. And, we know that in psychoanalysis, Freud was frowning upon religious beliefs. And yet again, this is something that's always been part of the human nature and religiosity and atheism for others. And as a therapist, there is no reason to make any kind of judgment about that, but to accept and respect it if it's there, and to equally accept it if it's not there. This is something that everyone has to find out for themselves. So logotherapy is applicable whether or not the person of the therapist or the person who's a patient is believing or not.
I wanna ask one more question about the title, the English title of Man's Search for Meaning. You mentioned that in the original German publication, it doesn't have the chapter of logotherapy. So obviously there were changes made once your grandfather realized how influential this book was. Can you talk a little bit about how he conceived of the change in title and why?
I would think that he was opening it up to the more universal topic that's underneath the story with the title Man's Search for Meaning, because meaning was what made the difference for him. And he often was asked, about the title when he was asked, your book is such a bestseller. How do you feel about that? And his reaction was always, I don't feel so great on that this is such an achievement on the part of the author. Although you could argue that, it's also a well-written book. But he said, if so many people are reaching out to buying a book, which by its very title promises to deal with the question of whether life has a meaning or not, that's not an achievement, but that's actually a sign that something's going wrong in society today. And this is what he referred to as the existential vacuum. And these are problems that are, again, universal, and they're unfortunately timeless. And so I think that's yet another reason why this book and lately even more of his books are coming back, and people are still reading them, and people are reading them again. A lot of people tell me that they read Man's Search for Meaning. It's again and again in several stages of their lives, finding different things in there that were helpful and that suddenly had a meaning to them.
It is an excellent resource, an encouraging book to come back to remind yourself of the kinds of questions that are important. My final question to you is that trip that you took as a 19-year-old to Toronto the first time you read Man's Search for Meaning and then stood there representing your grandfather and his work. When you returned, do you remember engaging with him about this book?
Not particularly, but he would often, I didn't do that because I didn't want to bring it up because it's still, I mean, it is an uncomfortable, you know, it was a sad time in his life. So I didn't feel like I wanted to bring it up. However, I absolutely could have done so because he would often start talking about something that happened, you know, in the camps or something that I knew from the book, as if, you know, and he told it in a way as if it was, you know, any other experience, and it didn't have any trauma attached to it, which kind of is actually not unusual for a lot of people who have been through trauma that, and, you know, and have processed it. Again, it's a sign that, you know, to a certain extent, you can come back and you can live a normal and a good life, even if you've gone through any kind of horrible experiences, which doesn't mean he didn't, you know, he didn't repress anything. He actually, I mean, he wrote Man's Search for Meaning. The act of writing and putting it down on paper, again, he talked about it when he met my grandmother shortly after the war. And she said, here was this man who you know, didn't know how to smile. He was a very serious man and only some time into their relationship, he actually started smiling again, or he, as he put it, once he started becoming a human being again. He came back and he decided to not always talk about those days because not because that was not because it was painful, but simply for the reason that he didn't think it was meaningful. And that again connects to something is you can see that you can see how he actually lived what he talked about, and so I think, you know, whatever you read that's written by him, you will get a sense of what logotherapy is about because it's so connected. It's indistinguishable. He would say, you know, what's meaningful? And if it was meaningful to tell a story from the camp because it, you know, had some relevance to a situation that maybe you were going through right now, he would do that. And he would even do that in his lectures. And sometimes he would talk about those experiences in third person. Again, not because he didn't, you know, he disassociated, whatever you might want to put there, but sometimes he did that to not distract from the story he wanted to tell and have people think, oh, okay, well, you know, now I'm involved in his personal story because if that was him, you know, let's put the attention there. But he wanted to bring examples of what's possible and how you can deal with certain situations in life. So yeah, sometimes he'd talk about that. Usually he talked about things that were going on in the present, or, you know, some interesting discussion that he had, or an interesting case of a patient. So he was very much in the present. He had worked his way towards the past to arrive and to fully arrive in the present moment.
Well, Alex, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you for all these anecdotes and insights into really one of the most amazing and encouraging books I have encountered. And I know this is true for many people around the world. It's been a great joy to talk to you about it. And I look forward to our next conversation.
So do I. Thank you very much. Thanks for this lovely conversation. Thank you for your questions. That's a natural discussion that we're having. I tend to forget that somebody else is listening.
Thanks so much for listening to the Viktor Frankl Project. If you want to know more about what we're up to, you can find us on Facebook or Instagram or on the web at www.viktorfrankelproject.com. My name is Chris Domig, and I hope you'll join us again soon.